tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 458 of the Tsunami Escape Podcast. I am C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
Crocodile can't make it. He sent us a last-minute message saying he had something come up, so he couldn't go join us. So it'll just be me and you tonight, Seda. We do have, like we were just discussing, a fifth show to talk about this week with the addition of Primal to the block. So that'll be exciting.
Yep.
As far as news goes, I only had two minor things I wanted to mention. There isn't any like big scheduled news or tsunami adjacent news that we're aware of, but two things. One is this past weekend, we did get a like special Tom and Sarah introduction to Primal Season 3 when they walked on to start the tsunami broadcast. They kind of just discussed it briefly, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was I did notice that most of the bumps throughout the whole night have all been updated. So most of the clips were from episodes that were airing that evening.
So no longer doing old One Piece bumps?
No. Yeah, Bill is no longer a part of the bumps, which was, thank gosh, they're actually showing Zoe stuff now. But that's about it. Nothing super exciting. The big news this week, of course, is what we already talked about, which is we've got Primal. So Speaking of which, let's go ahead and start with the rundown, and we will begin with Primal Season 3. Primal Season 3, Episode 1, Vengeance of Death. Now, last week, when we were talking over about our thoughts about like Primal in general and it coming to the block, I think I said something like, I think Primal is a really good show. I like the Genndy Tartakovsky, like very minimal dialogue that he tends to do in his shows. And I think this is a good example of that because I don't think anyone speaks in the whole episode.
Yeah, I don't think there was any dialogue at all.
Yeah, not a spoken word. Lots of grunts, lots of yelling, lots of motioning and communication, but nobody speaks. All right, so the episode starts out. We see an old man waking up. He's got all these arrows stuck into him, and he looks up and he sees that his village has been completely destroyed and is on fire, and there's dead bodies everywhere.
Yep.
I have the closed captioning on because that usually helps me take notes. And it does say old shaman, so that he's like a shaman. Even before I knew what he was going to do, it said that.
Yeah, and part shaman, part necromancer, because the very first thing he does is he kind of collects a few things to make some sort of potion, draws magic. It even gets like a shot with like a bolt of lightning. And then he goes over to a corpse in like a body bag kind of thing. And he's the one responsible for reviving Spear, just this unnamed shaman necromancer dude. So
yes,
we can just do that.
He does like two things. Like the first part is when he's creating the potion and stuff, he creates a sort of like this green glowing heart that he puts onto the top of a staff. Now I thought he was going to like put that heart into Spear or something, but apparently we learn that is actually like a way of controlling a zombie.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, he goes and he finds like where I guess Spear's corpse is. Cause he sees like some drawings on the wall, and we can see like what is clearly supposed to be Spear. And he's like, all the people are like praising him in the image. And he's like, this is my guy. And yeah, he revives Spear, turns him into a zombie. And the first thing he does is he uses that staff with the green heart, glowing heart on it, and he commands the zombie spear to attack the sort of tribesmen that massacred his village. And these are all like, I'm pretty sure they're human. We never see their faces, but they're wearing, I think they're wearing like skulls on their head.
Yeah, they look like just feral human, like scavenger type people. So
yeah, they make it. It was a little ambiguous. It's like, are these monsters? But no, they had too human of bodies. I think they're just like tribes people, and that's what they called them in the credits or the captions. They said tribesmen. So I'm thinking, okay. But so zombie spear starts decimating all these tribesmen. But one of them ends up getting like, I don't know if it's an arrow or something. He hits the shaman and kills the shaman.
Spear is no longer being controlled. He kind of just stands there. One of the tribesmen, maybe the same one, like cuts off a part of his scalp, which might be important. So Spear's part of his head is just exposed and his brain is just there.
Yeah.
Then that last tribesman just kind of runs away. While Spear just sort of stands there for a while, kind of like it's like he's readjusting to like his sentience almost. Like, wait,
yeah.
He's like starting to realize, like, wait, I have sight, I have feeling, I can move, I can observe things, perceive things. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's no spoken dialogue here, and he's a zombie caveman, so not like super in depth thoughts, but he's starting to realize he's alive, not really alive, but he's gaining his sentience back. Yeah,
it's I think there's a lot of that in this episode of him just standing and staring and just processing, and you get the impression, at least I get the impression, that he's struggling to think. Like, it's like he's trying to think, but I guess in his zombie form he's struggling.
And throughout the episode there's these thoughts in his head that are like these really obscured images and visuals, which are like his kind of memories coming back.
Yeah,
they start out very vague, and later in the episode there's some more clear ones, like, oh, there's Fang, like he's starting to remember Fang, which we have no idea where Fang is right now. There's like four or five of these throughout the episode. So
yeah, it's kind of giving you the impression that like his humanity is still inside there. Some of his memories are still in his head. He's just, because he's zombified, he can't really process that very well.
Yep. So the first thing he kind of does is he kind of just like slowly saunters over to like a lake, like a lagoon of some sort, and all the animals run away. He kind of looks at himself, and again, almost like a baby, like starting to realize his like self perception of like what he is or who he is, seeing his own reflection at this point. So yeah, this is pretty much the episode is kind of, like you said, Fear slowly realizing, you know, himself, his sentience.
Yeah, just trying to figure out what's going on and realize what's happened to me. What am I? Also, it's like, how do I put this? Well, anyway, like you said, all of the animals go away except for like a crocodile, which grabs a hold of him, but then it's like swallows him briefly, but then he just kills it and then comes out of the like blood soaked pond and just starts walking away. That's where we kind of get the first commercial break. When we come back, you can see that he's kind of walking by the side of a river or kind of flooded area. There looks like there's been a recent flood and the current is pretty strong. And then he hears someone screaming out that they're drowning. And this is one of those moments where he has like a flashback to someone who had screamed at him in the past for help. And he remembers helping them. And that's kind of gives him motivation to be like, oh, I need to help this person. And he does.
Yep.
And it turns out that this person is like a leper.
Yeah.
So it's in a kind of interesting twist here, you know, Fang looks very leperish in and of itself because like his like nose is rotted away. Like you said, half of his brain is partially exposed as a zombie. But then these lepers kind of look like him too, because they've got like bits of their own body coming off and stuff. But the leper is super thankful.
Yeah. Basically invites him to their village. Kind of like, hey, you're one of us. No dialogue, of course, but
yeah.
I don't know if he doesn't seem to realize that Spear is a zombie. He thinks he's just another leper. Kind of invites him to the village. So there's like a relatively long scene of kind of, him leading him to the village. I guess there's like a desert nearby. Yeah, they go through a desert to the village, and the villagers at first are very wary. Obviously, they're probably wary of all outsiders. But they eventually let him in. They eventually let him into his own tent, kind of like saying, you can stay here. And then this part actually kind of confused me. I think I'm supposed to be a little bit confused, is Spear starts drawing stuff on the, on the floor, like in the dirt. And it was like a couple of dots and a couple of like angled lines. And I'm like, I'm not sure what that's supposed to be. Spear is like remembering something. I don't know what. And maybe that'll be explained. So.
Yeah, in my notes, I just wrote down, he remembers writing something. And I agree. It's like he sees like a scorpion make marks in the ground, and he's like, oh, I can make marks on the ground too. And then he has a vision of something. I don't know if it's writing or a map or what, but he remembers something and he starts to draw that. But yep. Right after he's finished drawing it, suddenly this leper colony is attacked by these men on horseback.
Yep.
And they're, you know,
pretty brutal.
I don't know how to put it. Like, they're, I don't know how you place this in time. I have a lot to say about that in a second, but like, these guys, they're kind of wearing like armor. They look very Middle Eastern in like the kind of attire that they're wearing.
Yeah, they kind of look like Arabian. They kind of have that sort of like Arabian turban, some flowing cloths, but some armor.
Anyway, like I said, they attack all of this poor defenseless leper colony, but the Spear, you know, he sees that this is, you know, he hears more yelling and realizes, he puts two and two together and is like, I got to stop this, and, you know, beats the crap out of these horse riders. It's like super bloody and gory in typical primal fashion, and sends them away and end up leaving. And then the last thing that happens in the episode is then he hears a roar. Now, the captions, again, may be misleading or maybe true. I don't know. It said dinosaurs roar. And but this is what you said earlier, where he kind of has a flashback of thinking about Fang. And, you know, the whole like leper colony are really grateful and thankful to him for having saved who's left of their village. But then he just turns and just starts walking away because he's heading towards that roaring sound.
Yeah, like I don't know if he's really thinking clearly at this point, but he like basically remembers kind of this instinctually, like, I know that roar. I know I you know, it's familiar to me to some base degree, and I'm going to go in that direction.
So here's my question. It's not really an answerable question, but it's something I was thinking about. And I don't know if I'm really supposed to be this like detailed about it, but I noticed that a lot of the animals in this season are like modern animals. Like we saw,
there's like an elephant and gazelles and things like
gazelles, that. Yeah. Yeah. And everything looked pretty like more modern than dinosaur times. Now, again, this is primal. It's a little, you know, fantasy because, you know, dinosaurs and humans weren't around at the same time, but still, I feel like we've kind of experienced a time skip here, but I'm not sure.
I'm trying to remember, in the second season, all the other humans that we met are all very caveman-ish. Is that right? I'm trying to remember
There was that one, like, in the second season, there was that woman who led, like, this. They had a kind of more advanced society, kind of Incan.
They were, like, on a boat. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was trying to remember, like, you know, that was a couple of years ago, what exactly, like, what attire and outfits they had, like, if they had any sort of, like, metal outfit or anything like that. Or if they were all, like you said, like, Incan type, you know, still, like, ancient type outfits and technology and whatnot. But now we have no idea how long Spear has been dead, I guess.
No.
Like, obviously a dead body still rots to some degree, so it's probably not like 1,000 years.
No, I don't think so.
But like, could it be 100 years or 200 years?
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering that. I mean, like, again, and I also feel like I'm reading too much into it too because of the fantasy nature of the show.
That's true.
Like the thing that really made me think about is when I saw that elephant and I'm like, oh, an elephant and not a mammoth. Okay. But maybe there were always elephants. I don't know. Just something to think about.
Yeah. And like, we don't know, like, it's ambiguous how long Spear has been dead.
Like, I think that if he is going to be reunited with Spear, it won't be Spear. It'll be like the descendants of Spear or something like that. You know what I mean?
You mean Fang.
Oh yeah, Fang. Sorry, I get their names mixed up. Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I think enough time has passed that like Fang would long be dead and yeah, that kind
of thing. Didn't Fang have children in the last season? And what happened to them? Did they all die?
I don't remember. I do remember I remember specifically us talking about that there was like dinosaur childbirth in that season. Like, explicit.
I don't remember what happened to the children, if the children all died or not. No. I don't remember.
But again, if we're hearing dinosaur sounds, then maybe we're in the similar time period. It could also be a ruse that he's thinking he's hearing a dinosaur, but it's some other creature. We don't know yet.
Yeah.
Overall, my impression of this episode, that it was really entertaining and compelling in the storytelling aspect. I liked the slow pacing of it. I think the only thing I don't like about this premise is, like, do you think we'll ever not have a zombie Spear? Like, do you think there's magic that could, like, restore his body? Or do we think we're just stuck? He's going to be zombie until the day he dies again. I wonder that.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah. Like, you can only go so far with a zombie because, I don't know. But anyway, it was very well made. The whole time I was thinking to myself, it's like, yeah, this show's a real looker. Like, even minor little moments when he's just walking and sort of slogging towards the camera. And it's just like, it's so well animated. And the color use and the shading is all so good. It's like, it's a great looking show.
Yep. And I even, like, there's even, like, Gendy's works are oftentimes like this, where it just shows, like, a lot of environment shots. And then there was, you know, for example, it was raining at one point in the episode, and it was showing, like, rain hitting, like, the river. And like the puddles that form, and like someone had to animate that, and that's probably not easy. It looked great all throughout.
Yeah. And I did notice too, not that I was not expecting it not to be, but this episode was directed by Gendy Tartakovsky. I don't know if he directed every episode of the previous season. I don't think he did, but he definitely directed this episode. So
yeah, I noticed that too. And I understand what you mean, is sometimes even the creator only directs a few key episodes and relies on someone else to direct maybe other episodes. So we'll see who might direct in the season. And some of the names that were in, like, the opening credits, I think I recognize them from, like, the previous seasons.
Okay.
So
interesting stuff. Any other thoughts about Primal before we move on? Any other feelings about it?
The only thing I saw was, I saw someone note, like, the episode is on, was it on Adult Swim site or maybe YouTube even? And had like 500,000 views that first episode. Like, that's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Also, there was a promo for the next episode that aired on Toonami. And it was interesting that, and somebody, I think Grexino maybe in the thread pointed this out, is that they referred to it as on the next Toonami airing of Primal.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so that was like, I think, but it makes perfect sense when you think about it, because it's like, if they run that spot during the week or something,
it's like, hey, we already saw this.
Right, yeah, so having it say Toonami.
Yeah, so today is Monday, so I think the episode that aired like yesterday on Adult Swim would have been episode 3, I think. Mm. And then we get episode 2 next week, or we're either 1 week or 2 weeks behind.
I thought we were 1 week behind.
It might have been episode 2 that aired yesterday.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
So yeah. So, but that's actually sooner than I expected. I expected it to be like once the season's finished airing, then Toonami will get it. But no, we're just a week behind. So kind of like a, you know, we only get handed the rerun, but 1 week, not a big deal, really.
Yeah, and I think having it say like the Toonami airing, because they're probably going to have like promos for both running at the same time, and that'd be confusing. Yep. So interesting. All right. Well, that's it for Primal season 3, episode 1. Looking forward to more. Oh, by the way, do we know how many episodes? I guess I should have looked.
I don't know.
I saw a episode list on Wikipedia.
I'm just going to Google how many episodes is Primal Season 3 and see what the AI gives me. I don't. The AI is not helping. You know what the AI says? One. There's okay. One episode. It's probably like counting like how many have aired, or even though it's more than one now. AI is useless.
Yeah, this is in no way definitive. But a wiki, not even Wikipedia, but a wiki for Primal does list the first 7 episodes, and it has like episode titles for them too, which is kind of neat. I'm not reading them, but I can see the names that are there.
I would have guessed 10 because that seemed like the right. Standard.
Yeah, they've done 10 episodes the previous 2 seasons, so that's probably what it's going to be.
Oh, I actually did think of a small news thing that is sort of related to this.
Oh, okay.
That we didn't touch on at the top of the podcast episode. This isn't maybe too much of a surprise, but one of the creators of Invincible Fight Girl didn't say it explicitly, but more or less kind of confirmed Invincible Fight Girl is dead. Like, no more episodes. Okay. They're not coming.
I can't say I'm surprised.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, but like, if there was any hope that you wonder if it would get greenlit and they're working on new season, they're not.
Okay. Well, that's good to note that. Yeah, when we finished Infinite Fight Girl like a year ago or whatever, I really got that impression. It was like a trial, and then that it didn't really catch on the way they hoped. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next show on the block, and that is Bleach. Bleach, The Thousand Year Blood War, Core 3, Episode 7, Gate of the Sun. I've got very few notes for this episode. I think things go pretty quickly.
A lot of this episode was a big fight.
Oh. That's right, yeah. So the court guards teleport to take out the Soul Reapers. So this is the first scene we see Yuhavaha, and he like makes them each sort of like summon this like teleportation circle under them, and they zoom off. Meanwhile, we see all the Soul Reapers are on their way to Yuhavaha's new castle. And I did make a mental note here that they're all doing the Naruto run on the way there.
That's just aerodynamic.
I guess.
Everyone knows that.
It just made me think of that meme from a couple years ago where everybody was going to like run to Area 51 that way. Meanwhile, a couple of other figures show up at the Soul Palace area, and that is Mayuri and Kenpachi.
Yeah, Mayuri is basically like, I wanted to take a different path because I'm so super smart, and I'm going to just like sneak to the castle myself while everyone else is fighting. And Kenpachi's excuse is, I had to go take a piss and I was late and I just followed behind you.
Yes.
And then I guess a couple of the other people are there. Ikaku, Yumichika, and one other one, I forget the name, are there also.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So they have their own little mini squad there.
Right. I didn't mention them because I couldn't possibly place who they were. I just knew there were some more people with them, but I was like, I don't know who these people are. Mayuri also says that he's like, why would I want to deal with the scrubs? I'm going to go directly to where the castle is. That's the most interesting place.
Yep.
And they kind of bicker back and forth. I'm going to look at my notes here. Okay. We also see that Grimmjow is running alongside with Ichigo and crew, but he's kind of taking his own route a little bit up higher, further away. And then they run into the court guard, Askin.
Yeah.
And he's the one who's like, he's very cowardly, is how I would describe him.
He's not like a frontline fighter type. He is kind of a, he's not really even a schemer type, but he kind of just is like run and flee and pot shot you, like cheap shots type attack. That he does. So yeah, he spends pretty much most of his episode running.
Yeah, and it's not even like he's just running. It's like he's like openly like being scared and like not hiding it. You know what I mean? He's just like, I don't want to fight you. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, he doesn't say he doesn't want to fight him, but he's just like, I can't fight you. You're too strong. So yeah, he's being chased around by Grimmjow.
And then there's even a part in this run where he like takes a seat. He pulls out like a thermos and some like soup or something, or maybe just a drink. And then Grimmjow like catches up to him and then they start running again. Okay. Kind of silly.
It was actually goofier than that. He was like, oh, I finally lost that guy. This is a good time for some tea. And he starts drinking his tea. And Grimmjow's just standing behind him.
Yeah.
And he looks back and he's like, oh.
Yeah. Bleach can sometimes be goofy. I wasn't really expecting it here, but yeah. Not, it's kind of not super serious here. But he like throws, I forget his ability. He like, I remember it being really weird, like, if he can make, like, different liquids. Was that him?
I don't remember. Yeah, it was something about he changed the property of their blood or something.
He was fighting that Zanpakuto guy and was, like, he had something to do with his blood. And I remember he explained it, but it was, it's a very weird ability. So I don't remember it. But anyways, in this moment, he throws, like, a poison orb. And he's just like, you know, have a present. And Grimmjow just kind of like swats it away, but then it kind of bursts and paralyzes Grimmjow. So he's now on the ground, like unable to move.
Right. We also see Lile Barro, who's the guy with the sniper rifle.
Yep.
And he is basically set up on a tower and he just starts sniping Soul Reapers and like literally like putting holes in them.
Yeah. Like there's like three different Soul Reapers whose names I forget. There's like the tall gray-haired woman who was one of the nurse Soul Reapers. There's the Soyphone's lieutenant, the big guy, and then one other one that just literally just gets shot. Like, are they dead? Probably not dead, but they're just they got a hole through them,
so. Like a big hole, like enough that they were like, oh, the kind of thing you would see someone die from.
Like if this wasn't Bleach, I'd be like, those guys are dead.
Yeah, exactly. Because
it's Bleach, it's like maybe die, but
yeah, they're probably gonna get like healed somehow. But yeah, it looked deadly. And the captain guy was just like, we need to scatter. They're sniping us and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last bit of team sort of meetup that happens in before the commercial break is that we see that Renji and Rukia's little squad have now met up with Uryu and they're going to have a little battle. And this is, like you said, when we come back from the commercial break, a lot of the episode becomes just this battle. Between Renji and
this is actually a pretty well animated battle overall.
Oh yeah,
like I was surprised.
I thought this whole episode looked really good.
Yeah, yeah, even like the running animations of these goofballs. But yeah, this whole fight, like I was not expecting a battle between Renji and Uryu to be so like well animated and lengthy and sophisticated. But I do. I think I'm going to nominate this for best fight right now. Like this was a pretty darn. It's maybe missing some of like the emotional core that, you know, makes the best fight the best. Because these two characters don't really, they know each other, but there's really no like history between them or whatever.
Okay.
But still, just from a pure animation and like choreography and standpoint, this is a really good battle.
Yeah, I agree. And one thing I did want to ask you. Renji really goes out of his way to keep calling Uryu, you Quincy. He's like, I'm not going to fall for you, Quincy. Is this something specific to Renji about the whole Quincy hate, or is it just in the moment?
I think just kind of in general, Soul Reapers don't kind of look down upon Quincy's. Some of them might be like less harsh than others. I don't think this is specifically a Renji thing. I think it's just sort of like, on the average, Soul Reapers kind of view Quincy's as like lesser beings, and kind of Renji's sort of falling into that right now. Even though Renji is like a protagonist, he's always kind of been, you know, he's been around since like the very beginning of the show. He's always kind of been kind of like a hard head, you know, brash sort of person. So it's not really too surprising that he kind of just views Quincy's, as kind of lesser. So yeah, he just sees Uryu as a Quincy. He does know who Uryu is, but he's like, you're a Quincy. And it's like an insult to him.
Yeah. Well, that was, I think the reason I was asking is because it seemed like he was deliberately going out of his way to not call him Uryu. He's only referring to him as you Quincy.
He did that because he can't pronounce Uryu.
Well, I'm in the same boat.
That's a joke. Call him Quincy.
Well, speaking of Renji, he does break out his Bankai here. And I think this is like the first time that Uryu has seen this like new form of his Bankai.
Yeah, like the full name Bankai or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to.
He had a Bankai before, but it's like now it's like the upgraded version of it because now he knows his Zanpakuto's full name. But yeah, the reason why you don't have a lot of notes, I took some notes also, but you know, it's hard to take notes when it's just a big battle. Yeah. And honestly, I was sort of expecting, like, we know Renji's not going to beat Uryu. Like, that's just not going to happen. No matter, that's not going to happen.
I don't know, but you, I guess.
But like you figure it's going to be Ichigo, right? Or someone or someone with some history with Uryu. Like, it would just be so weird for Uryu to be like defeated by this other character. But Renji puts up a really damn good fight, and in fact, he almost. Everything's said and done, a lot happens, but after everything's said and done, he almost wins. Like, Uryu is down on the ground with like a big crater around him, and Renji is basically like, you know, about to take like a final blow, but then Uryu, what he kind of seems to do, and maybe I'm misinterpreting it, but he like absorbs like the reishi around him, because again, this whole like, or like the, I assume it's reishi, I don't know all my Bleach terms, but like he kind of like absorbs the energy like in the arena around him to like heal himself, and then kind of pulls off one last attack on Renji, and kind of it's like a Quincy bolt thing that goes through Renji's chest.
Yes, so this is the Quincy version of a Bankai, which I wrote down what these are called. This is another difficult word to say. It's called a Volstandig. But the Volstandig is Uryu's super move that he's doing here. I mean, all of the Quincy's have this Volstanding ability. It's when that big cross comes out from above them. But yeah, this is Uryu's Bankai, quote unquote. And yeah, it does. He ends up defeating Renji here, right? I think.
Yeah, he does.
Okay. But we're not done, because, like you said earlier, Grimmjow has been disabled by Asken. But here comes Ichigo to face off against Asken, and potentially probably will end up saving Grimmjow, which is going to be, of course, you know, like that's just what's going to happen. I can just tell.
Yeah.
Grimmjow is going to be like, why did you save me? You're my enemy, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I didn't want you to save me or anything. I don't know if you like that. But
yeah. And then that's pretty much, I think actually after that moment is when we come back and we see that Uryu ultimately.
Yeah.
Uryu has withstood Renji's attack and ultimately defeats Renji. So yeah, I even had it in my notes here. I forgot. So yeah, Renji's defeated.
It might be partially my fault, but the way we approached discussing this episode, the episode itself kind of flipped back and forth between the two scenes, like the A plot, B plot, a few times, but we kind of just talked about them separately. But you know, yeah. So I forget if the episode ended on Ichigo showing up or Renji getting shot, but it doesn't really matter. Both those things.
It's Renji getting shot. I keep all my notes in chronological order, and my last note is defeats Renji, which I think was the last thing that happened. But you're right. Yeah. I mean, like, I think it's one of the good things about the Bleach Thousand Year Blood War is the way they do the pacing. It's not like a One Piece or a Naruto. They do a lot of like jumping around, and it keeps the pace kind of lively, even if there is just battles going on.
Yeah.
And that is it for this episode of Bleach. Gate of the Sun is, I don't know, is that Mayuri's gate? I don't know what that is. It's probably something else. Oh, there was a very brief scene too. I didn't mention this in my notes, where we did see the lower Sternritters, those three characters we like, kind of show up, the fire guy, the zombie girl. And they're like
glutton.
They're kind of like recollecting about the fact that this is where they used to live, but now it's all different because it's been rewritten.
And I think Shunsui, the captain, was like, I forget what he says, but they're basically like, we're not following your orders. We're going to do our own thing. And I think he says after that, fair enough, which it is fair enough. Like, they don't have to listen to him.
Yeah.
So they kind of go off and do their own thing.
And then the flame guy, he says something like, he's like, we're going to get our revenge on Yuhavaha, and then they cut it off.
Well, I think they said the other guy, the blonde haired guy, they specifically.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they did. You're right. Yeah. Enough though, where they focused in on him in the episode. Like that guy's got a serious grudge against that guy as well.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Anything else?
Not for this episode.
Okay. Yeah. I thought it was pretty good. Not amazing. But I do like
it was a good fight. Like, that was, they put effort into that, like a lot. So this obviously wasn't like, as far as like the story goes in this arc, this fight is not the important part about this battle is that Uryu beats Renji because he has new powers. And it's kind of just showing those powers. They could have easily shortened this fight, maybe done like less extensive animation or whatever. Like, all it really mattered is that Renji gets defeated. But they kind of went all out on it. Like, they didn't have to. And, you know, it was just as far as pure animation goes, it was good.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, too. Like, I said this already, but I want to restate it. It's like, it wasn't just the fight. Like, I thought the whole episode looked really good.
Yeah.
I
think
this show has good production values overall, and this episode demonstrates that as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next show on the block, Blue Exorcist. Exorcist Beyond the Snow Saga, Episode 10, In the Falling Snow. We're very clearly not out of the snow, because the snow plays a pretty big element in this particular episode.
Yep.
So, we're following up with what we learned at the end of last week's episode. There's this Cyclops attacking. All of the X-Wires are ordered to head to Tokyo. And they're all getting ready to leave. And Shima's like, well, I'm off to do my spy stuff. And so he's going to do that, I guess.
Shima's weird, because like, everyone knows he's a spy and he's not trying to hide it. And he's like, I'm both a spy for Mephisto and for the Illuminati. And you don't know who I'm spying for at any given moment. And it just kind of, they just kind of accept it. Like, sure, whatever, Shima.
Yeah. We cut over to Tokyo. We see that Shura is there and she's helping the exorcist fight this giant Cyclops. She's specifically using Jack Frost.
Yeah. Really, we made several Shin Megami Tensei jokes or comparisons with Blue Exorcist, and like, here was a very, you know, basically mascot of that series, yeah. Jack Frost. And Lightning kind of shows up here also, and he does more of his, like, Lightning can pretty much summon anything, like, it seems like, and his chants are still remain, like, he starts some sort of aria or whatever they're called. And he always ends it with, and so on and so forth. Because apparently he's just super strong and he just doesn't need to like give the full chant. So he summons, like, this isn't really that important compared to other stuff that happens in this episode, but he summons General Frost. Basically uses that to power. Yeah. He summons General Frost. He uses that to power up Shura's sword. And that's how Shura basically fights this Cyclops.
Yeah. Yeah, I just got to say, hee-ho.
Yeah.
Now, while the fight's going on a little bit, there's still, like, other, like, lesser demons kind of around as well. Really funny moment. I didn't put this in my notes, but I remember just now, is that we saw a shot of a bunch of ghosts that were attacking the exorcists, and we see, like, exorcists with, like, garden hoses that they're just shooting them with holy water, I think. That may be.
Yeah, it's like the Cyclops broke a few like epitaphs or something that was like sealing away some maybe vengeful spirits or lesser ghosts or whatever. Like, not necessarily like individually dangerous, but it's like, hey, if you have all these vengeful ghosts floating around, that's not a good thing. So yeah, part of the exorcists are just fighting those guys back, apparently with hoses.
Yeah, with hoses. It just looks ridiculous. And it just reminds me of the bazooka stuff where it's just like, kind of goofy. Yeah. Like, this show doesn't want to, like, I don't know. I guess that would make sense, but at the same time, it's just silly. I don't know.
Just bring out the holy squirt bottles.
Yeah, exactly. The holy hand grenade. I mean, I'm expecting that to show up at some point.
Holy super soakers.
Well, while that's going on, Lightning confronts Yukio. And he says, hey, I heard about what happened. You were pulling a gun on Bon. And Yukio is shocked. He's like, realizes he's been kind of, the secret is out. But Yukio very quickly is like, oh, okay, yeah.
Well, I think Yukio asks him, like, well, tell me what you know about your investigation. And Lightning's like, nope, can't do that.
Yeah.
He says can't do that, but then Lightning kind of bumps into him, gives him like a phrase. And we learn quickly after that he gives him a thumb drive.
Yeah, there's actually something that happens right before that, but yes, that does happen. He at the moment it seems like he's not going to cooperate with Yukio, and he's remembering back to Bond being like on a phone call. Bond was like, maybe you should tell him, and Light was like, no.
I kind of agree with Bond. Like rather than leaving him in the dark, it might be helpful just to like let him know what we know, because you know I understand that point of view, and it's not like they know everything.
Yeah, he says something. I was like, no, it's some things you need to find out for yourself is what he says in that moment. But like you said, in a moment, he'll like change his mind. And the reason is because we see this new character come walking up to Lightning. And this is like this guy. He looks like he might be like Indian. I mean, American, Native American, I should say. He's very tall, big guy, got kind of red skin. He's got kind of like a...
Oh, yeah. They called him like an arch exorcist or something like that.
His name is Oscolia or something like that.
And I know we've seen him before. I think he was like at that round table, like the Exorcist round table. I think this is the first time he's really done anything other than, you know, spout a few things at that round table. But he's basically seems like he's on the same kind of a platform or rank or whatever as like Lightning and the other guy, the blonde haired guy. So he's a very high ranking exorcist, basically. What's his name again?
It's like it's really spelt weird. It's Oscela, so Oscalia or something like that. Oscalia, I don't know. Anyway, he's like, I'm here to take you in. And Light's like, well, that's going to be hard. I'm not going to let you. And then they have a little bit of a scuffle. But then, like, this is the moment where Light kind of breaks away for a moment. He runs up to Yukio and whispers, sushi is tasty, Oshina. And then... And Yukio's like, huh? And then they take Light away. And then Yukio reaches into his pocket and realizes that Light had stuffed a USB drive in his pocket, a thumb drive. Mm-hmm. It starts snowing. We're into the snow part of the show now. Everybody starts snowing everywhere. We go to the commercial break and we come back. We see that Yukio has put the thumb drive into a laptop and he was trying to look up some stuff. He starts getting all this data about Section 31 coming up.
It's basically the stuff that Lightning and Bond found when they visited like the past or whatever that realm that they went to with Mephisto's kind of help, help in quotes here. And Yukio even mentioned to himself a little bit later, he didn't learn anything specific about his parents because we still haven't learned that. We don't know quite exactly what happened. So Yukio hasn't figured that out, but he's obviously has learned a lot. And he even mutters to himself, the Exorcist and the Illuminati are basically just like two sides of the same coin or birds of a feather. Mm-hmm. I forget what phrasing he used, but they're both, you know, impure or whatever. Like they're both, they're like, you know, it's me against the world is Yukio starting to think this.
Yeah, especially because of the fact that he learns that Mephisto was behind it. And this is when he like the guy comes back. The other like random guy's like, hey, are you done with my laptop? And you just see Yukio like smashing it against a tree. He's so mad.
I think Yukio is going to be OK, guys.
I don't know, man. The next scene, he's kind of wandering around aimlessly. He ends up at the steps near where Shiemi's like he kind of thinks back to a moment a couple of years ago when he and Shiemi were in the rain and they had a nice little talk. But then we flash forward to the current moment, and then it's the same situation. He's on the steps, but instead of rain, this time it's snowing, and Shiemi again kind of comes out and sees him and invites him up, come inside. They have like a really nice like moment here where Shiemi's trying to comfort him, and Yukio lets a little bit of his feelings out. He's honest with her, and he's like, I don't know what to do. Everybody's against me. I feel I'm all alone in the world. Shiemi like hugs him and says like, no, you're not alone. I'm your friend. Don't you know that?
Well, actually, I think it's slightly different. Shiemi didn't hug him. He hugged her.
Oh, that's true. And that's important.
And like, it's also, I think everyone can see this, but this isn't like a romantic hug or anything like that. He just wanted like comfort of some sort. And like Shiemi is always like, she's known him besides like anyone else. Shiemi is probably one of the only people who knows Yukio really well. Because he's tutored her for years or whatnot. So, like, she's like a source of comfort for him. And literally, that's why he kind of just wanders there almost subconsciously.
I agree.
And then Yukio's basically saying, like, he's alone. He has no family, has no friends. And Shiami, this may not be verbatim, basically like, you do have friends, you have me, and you do have family, you have Rin. And that you were about to say, as soon as she says Rin, he loses it and kind of pushes her to the ground.
Yeah, straight up grabs her by the shoulders and just shoves like hard against the ground. And he's so mad. He's like angry. And then he gets up and he's like kind of shocked.
Yeah, he realizes like immediately, what the hell did I just do? Kind of wanders away. Shami's, of course, like torn up at this because she's not sure what's going on. And yeah, Yukio kind of takes the extreme here. A couple moments later.
Yeah, he goes into an alleyway, gets down on his knees, and he's just he's at the end of his rope. And he's just like, I've got to end this. And he pulls out his gun, sticks it up beside his head, and gets ready to shoot.
This was foreshadowed.
Yeah, exactly. He pauses for a moment and then pulls the trigger. We see the gunshot go off, the gun and the flash and everything, but the bullet is frozen in the air. It hasn't come. It came out of the pistol, but it stopped. And then we hear the voice of none other than Satan speaking to him. And he says something like, oh, you're not dying yet, or something like that.
Yes, I forget the precise wordings, but basically like, you don't die until I, you know, if I'm not going to let you die type of thing.
Yes.
So we did not know, like, we obviously knew that Yukio had like some sort of inner, like we've seen his blue eyes appear before. And that's why earlier in this season, or maybe it was last season, but earlier he was trying to like figure this out. And as soon as he actually truly wants to kill himself, like he truly wanted to, like he was decided he was going to kill himself. Mm-hmm. That's when Satan appears. And apparently is like cognizant. Like this isn't just like Satan dwelling, slumbering within Yukio. He's actually apparently like alert and awake and now intervening, maybe for the first time. Like I have some control here.
Yeah. I feel like there may be, my impression is that Satan has plans for Yukio.
Right.
He's like, oh, no. I let you do your thing most of the time. But in this moment, no. I'm in control.
And like, what is Satan's plan here? Yeah. We have no idea. Like, we know what Lucifer's plan is. But what is Satan's plan? Like, what is he planning on doing? Well, I don't know.
Really? I don't think we've really even seen him yet.
No.
So, well, right after this moment, Shima, who's obviously been spying, walks up to Yukio. And he's like, man, I didn't realize things were this bad, or something like that. And then the last scene is we go back to the dorm rooms. Bon is about to tell Rin. He's like, hey, I got to tell you something. You know, he's about to tell him about the fact that Yukio pulled a gun on him. But right before he says that, that's when Shiemi comes running in, panting, and be like, oh my God, there's something really wrong with Yukio. And that's where the episode ends. I think I kind of said this last week, or have been saying this, but I want to say it again, that the characterization in this show is better than I would have ever thought it was going to be. Maybe the first season or the first season and a half really didn't sell me on these characters that well, but they've definitely gone into some really interesting and compelling directions here. I think that the writer got better or something. I don't know what it is.
I agree. Like, not just Yukio and Rin, but like, I remember at the very beginning of this season, we were like, oh, Bon, they're giving some focus to him being Lightning's like disciple or whatever. It wasn't really expected, because normally with these sorts of shows, like Bon had his season and now he's kind of like done and let's go on to the next character. But no, he's actually been pretty darn important this whole season. In fact, he's the one who's probably been doing most of the actual like plot, figuring out the plot of this show. And then, of course, like everything with Shiemi, she's got some secret. She's a demon that we don't know about. The way that she's, her relationship with Rin and with Yukio is like compelling in a multitude of ways. And it's not just like shonen teenage romance. Like, it's deeper than that in terms of like what these characters mean to her as like people. And Shima's a little bit goofy and who knows what his deal is, but like, he's sort of a wild card at this moment and who knows what's going to happen with that. But I've said this before, and I think I said this on the previous episode, the fact that we've kind of like stuck with this trio, more than a trio, this set of characters throughout this whole show, and we're, you know, 50 episodes in or whatever it is. I think it's working out. And like I said last week also, the only character who hasn't really had much like character growth at this moment is like Kona Komaru. He's like the only one. So yeah. But otherwise, a lot of drama, a lot of tension. Like, obviously, you know, Shemi at this moment, or we ended the episode, is like completely distraught. And we don't know what Yukio's doing. And I think I saw you mention in the thread, like, character assassination for Yukio.
I meant that tongue in cheek. I will be clear.
Yeah, I think they built up to this. Like, he's been kind of struggling with, okay, I kind of figured you weren't being super serious, but like, I don't think this came out of nowhere. This isn't just like, you know, throwing everything that they built under the bus or anything. He's been like struggling with this kind of inner, I guess, he's comparing himself to Rin, his own like competence. Like, we're introduced to him as like this very, very competent exorcist, you know, beyond his years and whatnot. But we have learned since then that he kind of has like a complex where he, you know, at a glance, in a vacuum, he's a really competent, smart, talented person, but he doesn't see himself that way. And he has this like complex of comparing himself to his brother. He's never strong enough. And now this whole thing about like, he wants to learn more about his past and he's like obsessing over this. So he's been kind of been struggling for a long time, and now he's finally snapped. And I'm, you know, it's compelling. Like, I don't know where they're going to go with this. And also, we said this last week also, he hasn't done anything quite yet that is totally irredeemable.
No.
He's shoved Shiemi to the ground. He's pulled a gun on Bon, and that's the worst of it, which is pretty damn bad. But, like, if there was an episode, hypothetically, 10 episodes from now or whatever, where he kind of gathers himself and, like, you know, realizes what he's been doing and pushing everyone aside and profusely, like, apologizes for everything he's done and said, like, obviously it depends on how that takes place, but I am willing to hear him out compared to some other characters like Sasuke, where he's just like, yeah, sorry. And it's just like, you can't take it seriously, right?
Exactly. So that's what I want to clarify. And I wrote character assassination in the thread, and then I, like, a minute later, I thought to myself, that's not the right term. But what I really meant is what you've kind of hit on here is, or what you've been hitting on, is this idea that they set up Yukio as the Sasuke type character at the beginning, where he's a super competent, beyond his years, super talented, you know, it's like grade A student, the best. Like, the fact that he's teaching a class and he's the same age as his students, like that kind of thing. And he's like the best. And yeah, and then I guess it was, I want to believe that it was the author's intention all along to just destroy this character, to like just break him and just break him.
Yeah.
And it's really fun to watch this character just fall apart, because it's not something we see a lot in these shonen shows. You know what I mean? Like, and the Sasuke is a great example of how you don't do that right. And this is, I think, way more interesting, because this feels more real about how somebody can have a breakdown.
And we said before, his motivation for trying to learn more about his parents and even getting kind of upset at Rin for like Rin's more, you know, unwilling or almost uncaring, like, I don't really care about my parents, and he calls him a coward. Like, that's not actually like that. There's some sense to that. Now, obviously, he's, you know, gone too far since then, but like, there's some level of belief in what he's been struggling with. It makes sense that he'd be struggling with it. And it's not something that, like, is just his motivations aren't inherently, you know, inhumane or evil. But obviously, we'll see what he does at this point.
He's like his own worst enemy to a certain extent. Yeah. But I also do think that like circumstances have aligned to create the worst case scenario for him. So it's a combination of those things. I still think that there's something potentially manipulative about Satan that might be causing him to act this way. I'm not specifically saying like he's having his like emotions tampered with, but maybe more along the lines of like, he's in the worst case that it could be because of the situation that Satan put him in or something. But Anyway, yeah, really good stuff. I mean, it's you're right. Compelling is the right way to put it, because it's just like, if you'd asked me a season or two ago that we would see Yukio trying to kill himself on this show, I would have never believed it. Like, what? It's just, you don't see characters doing that on these types of shows. It doesn't feel like what we expect. I like that.
And not that I condone committing suicide.
No.
But like, it shows he's after he shoves Shiemi, which is like, besides like his family, which is Rin and Shura, Shiemi is probably his best friend, right? And
well, yeah, and she has feelings for him. She doesn't say it openly, but
and maybe they're complex or whatever. But like, he realizes immediately, like, I shouldn't have done that, and he's so remorseful, almost over remorseful, that he's like, I have to just end what I'm doing. I have to end it all. Again, I'm not condoning suicide, but he is like struggling as deeply as any individual person can struggle. And that's different than like, you know, a Sasuke type character just being, you know, unwilling to cooperate or selfish or whatever. Yukio is struggling.
Oh yeah, for sure. And like, we in our group watch, one of the people in the thread was like, Yukio, you suck, right after that moment. And I mean, obviously, everything you said is true. But at the same time, like, the fact that that scene could invoke a response like that from someone who's watching, like, that's exactly what we're talking about. So, all right, Blue Exorcist continues to be really interesting.
And in terms of like pure drama, the best on the show right now. I mean, not that the competition is great, but
no. Yeah. We're about to talk about a show that's the opposite of that, but I will say that, like, I think I'm more interested in the drama of the character drama with Yukio than I am about the story of Blue Exorcist.
Right.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just something I'm noticing. Well, speaking of which, let's go from a show that is super cathartic and compelling to one that's goofy and is trying to be a little serious and maybe not quite reaching those levels. We'll talk about Mashle. Mashle, Season 2, Episode 10, Wahlberg, Baigen, and the Greatest Danger. So yeah, the biggest problem with this episode is that it's too much focused on the Wahlberg stuff, and I don't really care. But the best thing that happens in this episode is at the very beginning.
I noted this too.
Yeah, so we see the big Afro kid and Rio Grants, the Divine Visionary. They're on their brooms on their way to the stadium. Now we get the name of the Afro kid here. His name is Nere Sean, N-E-R-E-Y, Sean.
Yeah, and say that three times fast and you'll get it.
So yeah, say it three times fast and you learn his name is Narration. That's great.
And even Rio kind of like pokes fun at this, because they're just kind of flying along. He's doing his thing where he's basically expositing what's happened. And as they're flying, he gets frozen. Nere Sean gets frozen. And Rio kind of makes a kind of a fourth wall breaking comment, like, dang it, he's frozen that he can't even narrate his own predicament.
Yes.
So that's what
they were kind of joking about that on the way too. They're like, they're saying stuff like, it's like, well, you didn't let the narration finish. We're do-do-do-do-do and stuff like that. They're breaking the fourth wall over the place.
Also, I checked his wiki page. Like, this guy he's 24?
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Like, I thought he was just like a teenager, like, or maybe like young adult, like very young, like college age, but 24 is like, that's older than I expected when like our main cast of characters are all like teenagers, but
yeah, he kind of looks 17 to me or something. Yeah. 16, yeah. 17 or something. Like, yeah.
Okay. Whatever. That wasn't what I expected. So
narration, narration. Okay. Well, meanwhile, there's a brief scene where all of the main Divine Visionaries and a few of the top tier students just sort of rally up in the, that's all I said there. They rally up, figure out what they're going to do. But then we cut back up into the sky and we kind of have the big Wahlberg versus Innocent Zero face off. This is them fighting directly one-on-one now. And it is time versus space. There are two types of magic fighting against each other. I will be honest. I don't remember anything about this fight. They're just blasting spells at each other.
It actually felt kind of Bleach-ish to me, where it's like, well, I'm going to use my space magic to cut away the space where you're doing your time magic. And then he's like, well, I'm going to do my time magic, so I'm going to revert time as soon as you do your space magic.
Yes. Yeah.
I actually did dive into the wiki very slightly. During this battle, Wahlberg uses an ability called, I noted this here, Uranus Inclination. And this gets into a little bit more of the mechanics of stuff, which I know some people don't really care about the mechanics of a shonen show, but I was like trying to understand.
It's kind of interesting sometimes.
So I guess when a third liner uses their wand, like to like where they like change the shape of their wand, we saw this first with Rain, and then with Cell War. They call that summon. And that's summoning like the god of the wand. This is maybe a minor spoiler, but I guess Rain's wand's god is Ares, and Cell War's wand's god is Hephaestus. And so these are like those are like Greek god names, right?
Okay.
And then Wahlberg, he uses his summon, and his god is Uranus. So that's why he says Uranus Inclination. And I guess what it is that's they call that a third. We joked about this. This is a third. So they have their seconds, and this is called a third. Now, I guess what Rain did and what Cell War did wasn't technically a third. Those are just summoning their like summon their like true form of their wands, which has like new abilities, but that wasn't necessarily like the third, like labeled as such. This is, I think, the first third that we've seen is like Wahlberg summoning Uranus to his wand and then using like an ability, like a special ability. And that's what they call a third. So I had to look this up. So I guess you summon your god of your wand, which then allows you to do a third, but you don't necessarily have to do it, which is like what Cell War did like in the previous episode.
The spell he casts, because I wrote it down, he specifically says spaces thirds. Uranus inclination. So he said that's where I wrote down thirds. It's plural. Yeah. So yeah. Goofy.
Delineating the mechanics of a shonen show can always get a little bit goofy, but I guess that's how it works. Is there been,
no, that's fine. I like to think about those things too. I mean, the problem is you can't take it too seriously, but I do like learning about the mechanics of fictional worlds and how they work.
And hopefully they're like consistent and not just throwing whatever at the wall, just whatever they need to, whenever it's convenient. So,
like, there's more world building mechanics of how the magic works in this show than I was expecting. Mm-hmm. It's not amazing, but hey, we're kind of learning things about seconds and thirds and stuff. You know, I find that interesting too. Right before that, though, we do see that we get a kind of Wahlberg backstory when he was like a little kid, and that's when Adam was really trying to recruit him to come to school. And so it's like this joke about the fact that he just gives him random animal trivia over and over. And then every time he ends it with, come to school, come to school.
Yeah, there's like trivia like, did you know giraffes only have to sleep 20 minutes a day? Come to school. Did you know the anatomy of a pig prevents them from looking up at the sky? Come to school. Okay.
Setting up that Adam was a really nice guy and that he kind of helped Wahlberg in his... But also, as someone else in the thread was pointing out, these are like hardcore death flags, which actually ends up not happening. But I was at this point expecting it. Like, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is all death flag stuff here.
Yep.
We come back from the commercial break and Innocent Zero is able to freeze Wahlberg using his time stop magic stuff. But Zero's attacks fail ultimately. And this is where, like I said, this whole backstory setup is kind of like about to pay off. Wahlberg is like, I'm willing to do this final move, but if I do it, it will kill me. But I'm willing to die to protect the world from you. And we see everyone's reactions down on the ground. Everyone's reacting to the sight of Wahlberg's super magical spell that's about to go off. in the sky, and I think even one of them is like, oh my god, he's about to die.
There's like a big sphere of light, and then the light starts like shrinking, and someone notes like, wait, it shouldn't do that, like they know something's wrong.
Yes.
I forget who it was said that. They're all the other characters like Caldo and Orter and Rio, and they're all there. Someone mentioned it, who knows, I forget.
Yeah, it's such a huge spell that like everyone in the Colosseum that is not frozen sees it and is like, oh wow.
Yeah.
But in the very last moment, Zero does a triple Keikaku reversal and says, oh, I just reversed time. I prevented your spell from going off. You underestimated me.
But I guess one side effect of what happened here, which is important, is because I guess Wahlberg and Innocent Zero were like in sort of like a cordoned off like subspace or something for a while, where like you couldn't see them. But because of this attack, they sort of like reappeared like in the world in the sky. And that's important because that allows a certain someone to like know where they are and see them.
Yes. So Innocent Zero grabs a hold of Wahlberg and pulls him up close, and he's like, well, this is the end, old man. We're going to end it here. And he like magics a kind of dagger right up to like Wahlberg's throat.
Wahlberg even starts like tearing up here. Like he realizes, you know, he's failed. And he's almost like, this is not compelling, but it's, I guess, tells us something about his character. He kind of realizes, are my own like philosophies about like what we should, what, you know, they keep referring to noblesse oblige. Like, are these philosophies, like, are they actually destroyed by this man's ambitions or whatever? So he kind of, like, does give up in this last moment here. But just after that, Innocent Zero gets punched in the face.
Right in the face. Well, he is kneed in the face.
Oh, is it a knee?
It's a knee from a certain super powerful man named Mash. It's a very satisfying, we get a really great shot for just a moment of like Innocent Zero's face as he's like reacting to the knee to the face. And it's just like, and I think like Mash says something here. He's like something.
I think he says like, hey, Wahlberg, remember what you said at the entrance exam? If I were to meet someone, that was like, you know, with impossible odds or whatever, something like that. Like, what would I do? I would punch them in the face or something like that.
Yeah.
That may not be verbatim what he said, but it was that, you know, that was the gist of it.
Now, somebody in our group watch thread made a good point, which I'm sure will be probably dealt with in a goofy way next episode. Is that like, how is Mash up there? He's just up in the sky now.
Now, we know that when he was playing like not Quidditch, he would just like move his legs really, really fast.
Oh, that's right. He did do that.
To like fly. So I'm like, is he just doing that again? I did notice, that they never showed his like lower part of his body.
No.
They only showed his upper half, his torso and up. But I'm wondering if he's just like kicking really, really fast to keep
that's what I'm flying. Thinking. I think the first shot of the next step is going to be like him doing like his legs just wiggling back and forth really fast in the air and like keeping him afloat somehow. But yeah, I want to see Mash punch the hell out of Innocent Zero. That'll be really, really satisfying to watch. And I'm sure in the next episode, we'll probably get like some dialogue between them, because like Innocent Zero is like, oh, you're my son and all this other stuff. So a relatively fine episode of Mashal. I think too much Wahlberg kind of attempts at pathos here that doesn't really pay off. But I do like learning a little bit about the magic stuff, and I definitely like the idea of Mash finally taking on the big bad.
And we only have 2 episodes left, I think.
Right. Of both Mashal and of Blue Exorcist.
I assume we're going to go straight into season 5 of Blue Exorcist, but don't take that for granted. Right.
So. That's right. I forgot there's the Blue Knight arc or whatever it's called.
Yeah. I'm assuming the Blue Knight arc, we finally get to learn about what happened to the Blue Knight.
I would have think so, yeah.
Considering what Toonami's done with Bleach and Blue Exorcist, I assume they're going to plan to just keep Blue Exorcist rolling, assuming those like that season is available from Aniplex or whoever has it.
There's no reason for them to stop now.
But yeah.
I do think that there's a good chance, though, that like Mashal's going to get replaced. Well, Mashal's going to get replaced Don. Yeah.
That seems the most likely.
Yeah.
Especially not only even without it, but especially because I did that sneak peek. It seems like they have to now, right?
Right.
So, that'll be fun.
Exactly. All right, well, let's move on to the final show, One Piece. One Piece, episode 760. The exterminated capital. The twirly hat crew arrive. There was a bit of debate in the group watch thread about the fact that it seems that
the control called it curly hat or something.
Yeah, it should have been called curly hat and they've changed it here to twirly, or one vice versa. I think they may have screwed up before. I'm not sure.
I don't know how much it really matters, but obviously it's supposed to be Sanji is, I guess, in charge, and he's got a curly eyebrow, or twirly eyebrow.
So the episode starts out, we see Cat Viper is sparring with Jack, but then the clock strikes six again, and it's like, oh, time to switch out again, time for the day people. And then the day people come back, and we learn that this battle just keeps doing that over the next several days. It just keeps swapping out. Meanwhile, even though Jack's forces are, you know, kind of slowly being defeated, he has more reinforcements being come that are coming via ship that keep arriving. But then the Beast Pirates do something that kind of turns the tide of everything. They break out these deadly gas bombs, which they got from Caesar at some point.
Yep.
And this gets kind of dark here for One Piece, I could say. You know, the Beast Pirates put on suits kind of similar to the suits that those guys wore in like Punk Hazard. But, you know, they put on these protective suits and they're just killing the Minks. And we see many Minks dying. Usually it's like they're dying like right out of the frame of the camera, but you can tell that they're dying. And meanwhile, the head Minks, both of the kings, as well as some of the main guards, they all sort of get crucified and put up on stakes and tortured. And, yeah, it's just like really, really brutal. And Jack just keeps torturing them until they'll tell him like where this samurai guy is or whatever, this ninja guy. And they're like, we don't know what you're talking about. And then eventually it's Wanda's explaining that, because this is all in flashback, of course, Wanda's explaining that eventually Jack decided to leave. And we learn after the break why. And that is that Jack had left at that point because he had heard that Doflamingo had been captured and defeated, and he was going to go and try to rescue Doflamingo.
Yep.
And this is then kind of, because this kind of goes back and forth between, like, you know, like everyone's sitting around the sleeping Duke Dogstorm and while Wanda tells the story between the flashback scenes. And so Wanda continues again. She's like, okay. And then the next thing that happened was that we see that the twirly hat crew has arrived, and we sort of see the moments of them first arriving at Zoe. And this is after the battle. This is interesting to me because I thought they were there during the battle, but my memory was wrong.
Well, we were, I think a couple episodes ago, we were trying to figure out like the timeline here. Because after Luffy defeated Doflamingo, there was a few days where they just kind of hung out in Dressrosa. But I think Chopper mentions, like, it was the day after Doflamingo was defeated, we arrived in Zoe. Like, I don't know how you know that exactly, but that's the timeline they established. It doesn't really matter, but
It was in the news. I think it was in the news. The news coups were probably telling everyone Doflamingo was defeated or something.
Yeah. But those guys get around fast. And so they arrive to Zoe, you know, this is a flashback. They need to get up the back of the elephant. So they use Caesar as a big, like hot air balloon, basically.
Yeah. I forgot about this too. Yeah. And then somebody I remember asking like a month or two ago, I was like, how did these guys get up onto the, no, this and is how
they answered that.
Yeah. They take the Caesar balloon up and then they split up. Some people look around in the town and other people look around in the forest.
They run into those two, Jack subordinates, whose names I had forgotten, but you wrote them down as Sheepshead and Jinrummy.
Yeah. So it's the guy and the girl, the two that sound the most like hillbillies.
Yeah.
And they attack, but I think...
Brooke gets to do something.
Yeah, Brooke actually uses some actual attack ability. He does his, like, everything like he does now is related to him, like, using the cold of death to, like, freeze things. So he freezes the ground.
He basically turns the ground into, like, an ice rink. And that little alligator fish horse thing they're on just slides and crashes.
Yeah. And this is, I think, why I might have been confused. Because, like, while Jack has left, I guess there's some beast pirates around.
No, this is a... Oh, yeah, right. This must be right after Jack left. Right.
Well, okay, yeah, that's it. That's the question. Is it right after Jack left, or are they going to run into Jack? I don't know. I think it's after Jack left, but
they must not run into Jack because they didn't know him, so...
Oh, that's true. Okay, good point. That's right. He's gone because the last scene of the episode is the other team, which I think makes up of who is it? Who's the ones in the city?
So Sanji went on ahead and he took Caesar and Chopper with him. And I remember this because Chopper kind of comments on the smoke gas that they run into. And then Nami stayed behind. Sanji told Brooke to guard her, and Momonosuke stayed behind as well. So yeah, there's two groups of three.
Okay, so one of those groups arrives in the city.
That's Sanji's group.
Sanji's group, and we see, I don't know if his name was said, but we see a mink on the ground who looks like a tiger or like a leopard.
Yeah, one of the musketeers or whatever.
Specifically, it's a musketeer for Cat Viper, who may or may not have had their name mentioned before. I will tell you that this is a character that sticks around a little bit. Oh. But anyway, I'll go ahead and say his name because it's not super important. His name is Pedro.
Okay.
Anyway, Pedro is the one who speaks up and he's like, "You must help us. Help save Duke Dogstorm and Cat Viper. They're our rulers. They cannot die. Please help save them." I do remember this. I remember that Caesar is with them when they arrive in the city because the gas is everywhere. And he's chuckling because he knows that it's his gas. Yeah, and that's where the episode ends.
I don't know if this is worth mentioning, but it does show Dogstorm and Cat Viper on their little crucible or crucifixes. And Dogstorm has lost a leg and Cat Viper has lost an arm.
That is true. Yes, that is worth mentioning.
So, like, they were truly tortured.
Now, a lot of this stuff I don't remember, but I have a feeling that Caesar is going to use his ability to, like, just remove the gas everywhere, right? I mean, like, that's what he would do.
Or they'll force him to.
Although, exactly. They'll force him to or something, but, like, yeah, if there's an easy way to clean up the gas, it's just the guy standing next to them.
Yeah, Caesar is kind of an interesting thing that he's being tagged along, because he's an evil person, but Not because he really cares about like the world government or anything like that. He's just sort of a mad scientist type. Like he wants to just create deadly weapons and gases and bombs and, you know, getting paid. And he doesn't care about the ramifications of anything. So if he sees one of his creations being used in this way, he'll relish in it. But yeah, they might force him to do something about it.
Yeah, he's very evil in so far as like, you know, he relishes, like you said, like he doesn't really have a good moral core. He reminds me of that, the light guy scientist from Bleach a bit, but yeah, probably worse.
Yeah. He's sort of like a mad scientist, self-centered type. Like he's not really in league with anyone else, kind of on his own devices. And yeah, if Doflamingo or Kaido or whoever are like purchasing stuff from him so he can like, or funding him or supporting him so he can just do his mad experiments and his weapons and whatnot, he'll do it. So I'm not saying he's a good person. He's just kind of like, I don't know what his goal is right now. His goal is just to escape, I think.
It's worth remembering because they don't really illustrate that in this episode that he is their prisoner.
I was not expecting him to like stick around.
Yeah.
He is a prisoner.
He does stick around because their goal is to like, use him as leverage or something against Kaido. I'm not entirely sure what they're going to do, but they've got him as a prisoner. But it is strange to me, even though he's a prisoner, they just let him walk around. I guess they're not worried about like him running away because they probably catch him or something, I guess. And that's the episode. Just more, again, like I said a couple of episodes ago, it's like Zoe is just like almost an entire arc told in flashback. Everything's happening in the past. What are your thoughts so far on this arc? Are you like, is it mid? Are you like curious, or are you kind of bored? Like, what's your feeling?
Maybe a little bit bored, because I don't really care about Cat Viper and Dogstorm. And like, are these characters actually going to be useful or important or cool? And the fact that, you know, Cat Viper is out of the picture, really, and Dogstorm has basically been beaten in his bed. I mean, I'm assuming he'll come back and do something at some point, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And also, like, the whole, like, musketeer element kind of feels a little silly.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't hate it. It's just kind of like, I am curious about, like, where are they going with this? And also, the whole reason why they're here is because, basically, Law wanted them to come here. And that makes sense now, because Law's crew is there. And Law's whole goal that they decided on hundreds of episodes ago is they want to take out Kaido. They just, Doflamingo was almost just like a stop on the way, in a way. It was a long stop on the way, but like, okay, they have some goal. They have like, their goal is Kaido, but what's the plan? And they had to stop by Zoro to figure this out. None of this was expected, you know, why they're searching for this samurai here, or this ninja or whatever. What's up with that? So kind of feels like almost like a not filler, but like a unexpected side quest that we have to figure out first before they get to the main plot.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, because like you said, they basically were going here to find Law's crew because they had the Viva card to Beppo, but they're kind of caught up in this, everything that's happened here. I will say that, like, of all the stuff that happens in Zo, the most interesting stuff hasn't happened yet. So I will say,
like,
that
I'm still curious, like, what's up with Sanji?
Yeah, exactly. That's one of them. There's actually like two or three things that happen later on that are kind of like, oh, okay, this suddenly got interesting. But yeah, this is the part of Zo that I'm the least interested in as well. I concur. I don't have a problem with these Dogstorm and Cat Viper characters, but like, yeah, it's not as interesting as the stuff that happens later. Okay, well, that is it for the rundown. Let's go over a couple of flavor alerts.
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
So you said you wanted to nominate the Uryu and Renji fight.
Yep. Like I said, really well animated fight. Assuming we're going to get more fights this year. The one thing it's lacking is that, like, there's less of that, like, emotional core underneath the fight that makes this, like, a meaningful fight necessarily. But just in terms of, like, a pure animated fight, it was well done. So.
Yeah, I agree.
Best name, of course. We have an obvious one here.
Yeah, we've got to put in Narration as a best name. Mashal is full of names.
We are like 3 weeks into the year and we have three Mashal names.
Sitter Baby, Necross Mance, which is Necromance, and Narration. Or it should be Narration, I think.
Yeah, it's Narration.
Narration, yeah.
You could almost put Adam Jobs there. Even though it's not like a pun or anything, it's just kind of... like, that's your name, Adam Jobs. Like, it's like, out of all the names, I'm biased to this degree, but like, out of all the names in this show, Adam is just like a very plain name, and then like Jobs.
Yeah, it's weird. I guess we can, but I don't feel strongly about it. But
compared to the other ones, no, the other Mashal ones kind of overtake it.
The thing that's funny is that like the Mashal ones, I wasn't expecting these like puns. That's just really great. Anything else this week?
No big voice performance that necessarily was good. I thought Wahlberg's voice performance in this episode was pretty good, but not good enough to be nominated.
Okay.
Granted, the material he was working with wasn't great.
I go back to what I was joking about last week about nominating Yukio as a best villain. Like, if anything, this episode really makes me want to like definitely not do that.
Maybe best character later, but we're literally in January. Let's wait and see how it turns out.
I'd say right now I'm definitely on board for that, because this is definitely he is the talking point of this show right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's really interesting. Like we were saying earlier about what they're doing with this character, the deconstruction of the you know, the stoic super guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
the type of character that they should be relying on has become unreliable, like very unreliable.
Yeah, so. Like they just destroyed this character. I said character assassination, but that's not, that means something different. I just mean that the author has taken this character and had put their life through hell to the point that they're going to shoot themselves. Yeah, I don't think I have anything else I can think of.
No, we got two. I think that's good.
All right. Well, that will do it for this episode, episode 458. Thanks for being here, Seda.
Yep, no problem.
We got two more weeks, or kind of, until we record our award show. So still looking forward to that.
We'll just have to remember for the award show, like for Mashal, for instance, or Blue Actresses, for instance, it'll be like stuff that happened and only in the first half of the season.
Right.
Like, obviously, we have our nominations, so, like, only those. So, but, like, when we're talking about, like, best show, we're going to be talking about, like, first half of Mashal Season 2 and the first half of Blue Exorcist Season 4. So you have to remember, you have to go a few weeks back, but it's not a big deal, really.
Exactly. Now, I'm with you, because, again, some of this late, this stuff that's happening with Yukio now won't really apply to the 2025 stuff, so.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, with that, later. Later.